Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their different experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital. Today, we get the opportunity and pleasure to get to know Morgan Simon. Morgan is and has been a leader in the impact investing area for nearly 20 years. She has influenced over, and this is a significant amount of capital, maybe you'll have to explain this, $150 billion of capital. And her book, Real Impact, The New Economics of Social Change, can be found everywhere from Harvard Business School to United Nations. She's founding partner of Canada Group, a registered investment advisor. Thanks and welcome for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. Great to be here.
I'm assuming our audience knows some about you, but if not, let's just start at the beginning. Give us a little bit about your story, where you grew up, where you went to school, and then just a high level of your career.
Sure. I grew up in Los Angeles, which is a very large and segregated city, both racially and economically. And I think that it gave me exposure at a very young age to inequality. And really within that, learning particularly, so I come from a middle-class family and spent a lot of time volunteering in low-income communities, mostly Latino immigrants, mostly in the downtown and East LA areas. And I think came to an understanding at a pretty young age of just how the interlocking nature of so many issues hit families, whether it was, you know, difficulty getting a job, paying a living wage, meant that you had subadequate housing, meant that your kids went to a school with subadequate education, and how money was just at the heart of so many of these problems. And realizing that from my position of educational privilege and cultural access, that that could be a place where I could really try to make a change. And that I generally think of social change as the intersection of economics, politics, media, and culture, and in general, kind of straddle those worlds within my work. Over the past 20 years, really focused on investment practice and with Candy Group, which is an RIA, really registered investment advisor, I should say that for regulatory purposes, that really focuses on social and environmental impact in everything that we do. Also as a senior contributor to Forbes, you know, writing stories about money and social justice, really trying to work on changing the culture of money overall. And you asked about my educational background. I have a BA in economics and political science from Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, and really credit that liberal arts experience for the type of in-depth questioning and inquiry and writing that comes within the diligence process and preparing me to write my book as well. I've done the course in Certified Private Wealth Advisor, I think that's the acronym, CPWA, at Yale School of Management more recently, and in general have been teaching a fair amount at different business schools across the country and the world. I actually lectured at Oxford most recently, so I've had some exposure in that academic environment, but really most of my learning has been learning by doing in the context of managing investments over all these years.
Maybe I'm going to give you my bias here, but I love the fact that you are teaching. But I also love the fact that you're doing what I found in the impact space. There's a lot of talking. And so there's an ultra level of respect from my perspective when there's people who are actually doing and risking their own time and talent towards this. You know, you talked about growing up in LA and then all of a sudden you started helping in these different communities. That is awesome. But I can got a lot of friends and whatever that grew up in LA and they didn't go that route. So what drew you to some of those experiences that you ultimately had and that shaped you?
I would say that, honestly, I was always kind of that way, just always really cared about other people. And I think the other piece that I feel really grateful to have learned from a young age, I feel like I got to see and experience the difference between solidarity and charity. And the idea of charity being kind of viewing people as less than you and trying to help them get to your level, or solidarity being really thinking about, you know, if I love and care about these people that I'm in deep relationship with, and therefore I want them to thrive in the same way I'd want any family or friends to thrive, and really having, therefore, that when I would see some of the conditions that people had to face, like really having the outrage because it was happening to my friends is what it came down to. And that's a very different posture relationally to be within community. And I think that's really important in the context of impact investing, where we're constantly learning from affected communities what their needs are. And that's a big reason why in the about $170 million of assets that we've deployed as Candide Group. You know, the majority of those since inception have been in businesses led by women and people of color. Over the past 3 years, that's been over 75%. Mm. The idea that we're going to do the best work by investing in people who are closest to both problems and solutions and coming from that lens of solidarity versus charity. So I don't have a great answer as to why I was that at such a young age.
Right.
But I would say that hopefully it's part of what makes me effective as an impact investor, right? Is being able to carry a really deep attitude of empathy and solidarity in the communities that we work with.
So it's interesting. You mentioned solidarity and charity. When I was 19, I started going into the prison system. Mm. I was visiting. And then that's been for the last 30 years. I've personally, and ultimately this will be common good, or have invested in multiple businesses run by and or that hire formerly incarcerated. And it's funny, one of the things I always want people to know is I'm not investing in these men and women because I necessarily, because I feel sorry for them or they need a handout or whatever. I'm investing in them because they're human beings who need access to capital just like anybody else. And the irony is my real calling, besides helping these men and women, which I have a deep passion for, but I actually want people who've not been impacted by the prison system to be have their hearts changed by investing in these men and women. So it's kind of counter to what one might think, but the wording of what you described is fascinating. I hadn't heard of it I shouldn't say that. I've heard you speak before and I've heard you say it before, but that's powerful. Thanks for sharing those words. How would you best describe yourself in the context of where you are in your life journey?
Ooh,
I know it's a simple question.
That's a big question, but I'll roll with it. What's interesting is that I think it was 2017 that I published my book, Real Impact, The New Economics of Social Change, which was kind of a career retrospective book. And it's kind of interesting that after you do that, right, when you're basically saying, here's everything I've learned about impact investing so far and everything that I think it should do moving forward, to some degree, it's like, I've given people most of what I knew.
Right. Yep.
And I think that does connect to what you were saying in terms of I have been focused a bit more on teaching and mentoring, and from that perspective, also learning from what younger people are coming up with, because it's inevitably more interesting and innovative, and making sure that impacts my personal practice, right? That it's not like knowledge is a static thing you arrive at and you're done, but being able to hopefully make some steps easier for future generations by letting them build upon what we've done, I think is really critical. And I had someone refer to me as an elder the other day, and at first I was a little bit looking around like, wait, me? Like, who are you talking about? Someone older than me, right? But I think the moment at which we sometimes embrace that status just opens up more space for sharing. And at the same time, I would say in the context of Candide Group and the work that we do, we're not to use the cliche, really only getting started, in that when we kicked off, we originally just worked with one family for the first 5 years and moving their assets 100% to impact investing. And that has expanded over time to now be a mix of families and foundations and different institutions that we work with that have those deep social justice values. And I think that every day we're kind of challenging ourselves to think about how do we work more broadly to really challenge the traditional culture of money. Some of that is about very simply loosening the vice grip sometimes mm-hmm. that's on capital, and how do we get that flowing to more communities and structures that make more sense, and identifying innovative capital owners who are really excited about that process, right? Because I think one of the trends that I've been really excited to see is just a greater emphasis on holistic legacy in the context of investing, right? When we think about what's the purpose, and going back to, you spoke about working in the prison systems, we've been extremely active in the question of private prisons, right? And when are times that companies are actually making profits off of locking people up. And I think for a lot of people, the idea that you could be locking up someone else's family to build wealth for your own is not the type of legacy that they're trying to build, right? And that it's just as important to be able to say to your grandkids, here's the wealth that I created for you. And here are all the lives that I've touched in that process, as opposed to leaving this roadmap of lives that have been harmed, right? That then the next generation feels like they're responsible for cleaning up. So I would say that we're trying to really create the most efficient waterways for money to move, for investors to be able to fulfill their objective as much as possible from both a financial and a social perspective, while also making sure that we're really listening and being responsive to the needs of capital at the grassroots. So it's not just saying that impact investing should be whatever wealthy people want it to be, but really to have that be a conversation that's in a strong alliance and solidarity, dare I say, with affected communities. So that's where I see our work continuing to grow and evolve. That's the conversation that I want to continue to be having and to continue to take to scale with Candide Group.
I've been at this now for 6-7 years, and obviously you've been doing this longer than I have. And to some degree, I feel like I just keep banging my head against the wall. Although I clearly have seen stuff shift over the last 2 years. I think COVID and some other things have accelerated that. But what would you say to the traditional, say, stereotype of a financial advisor, a wealth advisor, who kind of looks at this and says, I don't think I have clients that are really interested in this. And yeah, I don't know that you can actually make money. I'd love to hear your argument to that group.
You know, one thought that pops in my mind is the no one gets fired for buying General Electric is real, right? That it's very easy an advisor to be able to say, oh, well, I kind of, you know, I'm trying to beat the traditional benchmarks, and the best way to do that is to just make sure that I'm kind of sticking to the median, as it were, right? Like, don't stick your neck out with new approaches necessarily. I understand where that instinct comes from. And also, you know, we take fiduciary duty just as seriously as anyone else. I guess what I would say is I would go back to the question of, do you really understand how your client is defining legacy and all the different things that they care about for their family, for their community? And if to some degree, you know, if I'm able to, for instance, if I know that this is a client that cares a lot about education and that they're donating a lot in that area, if I can bring them an investment that's going to support education and also pursue financial return, that is a win-win, right? And then all of a sudden, I am absolutely number one on their list in terms of being able to pursue their objectives effectively. So I would view it as an opportunity to educate clients about ways that they can be fulfilling their personal missions, their family missions more effectively by leveraging this as an opportunity, because philanthropic resources for most families, not all, are going to be a really small proportion of their overall assets, right? So if I'm able to use more of my assets towards the things that I care about, or, you know, the flip side of that is also avoid the headline risk that can come from not really knowing where your money spends the night and then being stuck in stuff that's really horrid. So to give a small example, and one that I've written about pretty extensively for Forbes, you know, during the family separation crisis, you had, you know, the big name banks that we all know and many of us have been invested in, right, where it's Chase or Wells Fargo, Bank of America, BNP Paribas, et cetera, Barclays, who were invested in the private prisons that were holding these parents as children were getting ripped from their arms, right? So you see this happening in the world, but don't necessarily know that it's your dollars that can be part of financing that. And I think that when people learn more about where their money spends the night, they start to say, that's not what I thought was happening, right? I don't want to fund family separation. Who wants to be part of that, right? And if that means that my money could go to education or something that's much more aligned, now I'm really holistically fulfilling my objectives, right? So I think we always think about how our money is showing up in the world, that can be that mix of both financial and social objectives.
You know, one of the things that I talk about, and I talk about how I grew up in the financial world, and it was pretty much, hey, keep your emotions, keep your values out of it. You're only going to make bad decisions. My basic belief is you can't keep your emotions out of it. So why not bring them in? Why not align them with your values? And actually, the more that you can align your values with your investment capital and how that impacts the common good, then actually you start to loosen your grip and on your capital. And the normal what happens when you tighten things up, there's fear and greed that can easily creep in. It's not that anybody's bad, it's just the way it is. And the more you open your hands up, there's actually a joy and freedom that can come in on the investing side. And people, I mean, I've experienced it personally. I've watched other people experience it. And so for me, I'm actually doing this to try to help people start to feel a joy and freedom around their investment capital that normally just grips them or can.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I think one of the things that you're pointing to, Jeff, that's really powerful is that traditionally the way that we are taught to think about our money and to think about how we would engage an investment advisor is that more is always better, right? That is the objective is just grow. And that basically means you can never be satisfied, right? Because mm-hmm. there's no kind of rubric of when are you done? How much is enough? And that's a very American way to view the world, right? It's something that I talk about a lot in the book as well. And I think that that's where kind of sitting more deeply with some of these questions around what's the origin of the money that I hold? How do I feel about that? What's the process of accumulation and who was impacted along the way? Who do I want this money to serve? Do I have as much as I need? Do I not? Is there a number that I actually could feel is kind of enough? Or is it infinite, right? And I think for most folks, if you come with that infinite mindset, you know, it's just like in that same way, we can't all live forever. We can't all be young forever. We, have to adjust to these processes to not be miserable all the time, right? To not be feeling like we always lack. And I think a lot of the, you know, even scientific research has shown that attitudes of abundance tend to lead to happier lives, right? And that people who give away more tend to be happier. So that's where I kind of go back to, you know, what is going to make you happy? And is it about a collective basket of values? Is it about feeling like the money that you made was done in a really ethical way? Is it that you want to make sure that you're able to, you know, have enough for all your grandkids to go to college? There's specific types of happiness that money can buy. And at the same time, there's types that it can't. And being really clear on what are the ways that your money growing can and can't bring happiness, and what are other ways that it could actually buy you some happiness, right? By showing up properly in the world. That to me is the broader objective that we always really try to be aware of.
So just yesterday, my wife and I, there's a house, I don't know, five down from us. And unfortunately, the gentleman was older. I think he was in his 90s and he passed away 3 or 4 mm-hmm. months ago. So they had an estate sale. So here we are. And we really didn't want anything. We just were going to check out the house, to be fully transparent with you. But we walked in there and it was a couple things hit me. Number one, it was like a bunch of vultures preying on somebody's, you know, somebody passed away, their stuff. And the other thing, you're like, this guy couldn't take any of this with him. I mean, it just hits you like a ton. I mean, we all know it, but when you see it again, you're like, people are scrounging over his stuff. So what we accumulate means nothing at the end. So anyways, yeah, just a great reminder for me just yesterday.
Yeah. And I guess the one thing I want to add, I think sometimes people think when we're saying go do impact investing, we mean that you have to lose money. That's sure. not necessarily the case either, you know, and there's certainly, you know, any number of studies on how impact investing has often beat the market, right? And obviously, you know, it's every organization is unique, past performance, blah, 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 you know, all that stuff. But I do think it is important to note that whatever your goals are, you can still pursue them. But it's kind of knowing why your goals are your goals rather than just assuming that the goal is always endless accumulation with, you know, no thinking about what the impact of that money on the world is, right? That we can include more factors in our analysis. And then the other point that I think is really critical to highlight is that even actors that are 100% financially motivated have been paying more and more attention to social and environmental dynamics because they absolutely influence financial yeah. return, right? So, yeah. Yeah. you know, going back 20 years, that Swiss Re, the insurance company, they were the first to step out and say, we're not going to insure any company that doesn't have a plan for climate change, because climate change is going to fundamentally change the unit economics, a lot of businesses, right? So that was a business decision. That wasn't an environmental decision, but the impact is the same in terms of then corporate actors having to really take a hard look at, well, if I'm a fossil fuel company that only has 30 years of reserves, I'm hoping to live more than 30 years, right? So yeah. if yeah. I'm invested in that, boy, I really want to make sure they have a plan here and that it better be centered on figuring out a pathway to renewables or we're in trouble. So I think it's important to note that impact investing isn't just about bleeding heart people who want to lose money. There are definitely some people who say, I have more money than I need in this lifetime, and my investment goal is to thoughtfully reduce it by half. That's a totally reasonable goal. There are others who are first generation wealth holders that I work with where, you know, they were the first in their family to go to college and they want to make sure their kids can go to college and they reasonably want to accumulate capital. So it's not to say that there's one ethical posture, but just that most people never stop to really have that heart to heart, you know, with themselves, with their family, and that that needs to be the basis of any decision-making after.
Well, we see this firsthand. So Common Good is a GP in a company that is putting together a fund. It's actually on the other side is my brother who lives in Rwanda and a team of people.
Oh, nice.
And we're doing renewable energy in East Africa. And so it's fascinating when we bring this up to people on one hand, and I'm going to go to the extremes. Yeah. On one hand, the group's like, oh, this is renewable energy. So it's going to save the world. You can't lose. And on the other hand, it's like, oh, this is all about the Green New Deal. I don't want anything to do with it. And the truth is in the middle. You're like, well, there's 600 million Africans that don't have access to power. And the most logical and actually economic and best for the environment is renewables. So like there is no other, sometimes actually there's this force behind you. Like, no, this just economically and environmentally and socially makes sense. And that's why we're doing it. So it's hilarious. Actually, it's not hilarious. It's sad when we talk to people, we quickly see where they're coming from on this. And you can go, no, you can actually use your head and your heart and make money and be unbelievably impactful for in this case, you know, individuals in Africa. One other quick thing I want to say to something you said is, and I can see where people will be mad when I say this, but look, part of the American dream, I totally agree with. But I think we've also misconstrued this American dream that you get the white picket fence and, you know, everything that follows, or all of a sudden you have X amount of dollars that life is glorious. And I think, honestly, that's a lie. Now, that's not to say that on the other side of the spectrum, clearly, you know, having enough and whatnot makes a difference, but and everybody should have an opportunity for that. But this idealistic goal that if you get that white picket fence and you have that one job that makes X amount, all of a sudden life is great. It's like, this is not true, which goes probably back to the mindset of more is better in the traditional mindset of financial planning. When did you realize the power of capital and what did that look like for you?
I left Los Angeles at the tender age of 17 to go to Swarthmore, which has $1 billion endowment. And when I got there, I was kind of keenly aware that this was probably the only time in my life I was going to be a billionaire. You know, I'm not done yet, right? We'll see. But let's, you know, from that perspective, really thinking about positional power. And that's something I also talk a lot about in the book and otherwise, of like the concept of the accidental billionaire, in that most of us, if you trace our connections, whether it's the bank that you bank at or where your alma mater might be, or you know, any number of institutions we're connected to, you're connected to $1 billion in some way, right? And you can have some degree of influence. You may not have like governance level control, but even as a student or an alumni, right, to be able to write in saying, you know, I'd happily send my check this year, but I want to know how that money's being managed and is it in alignment with the university's values. So I joined the Committee on Investor Responsibility when I was at Swarthmore, and wound up filing a shareholder resolution with Lockheed Martin, asking them to add sexual orientation to the non-discrimination policy and to give domestic partner benefits, you know, because this was way back before ENDA or any of the policy that really, you know, mandated this.
People are going to try to figure out when you're in college now.
That's
you,
okay.
You don't have to say, I'm just teasing you.
Basically, we won. that's a critical piece there. And I was, you know, and I go through this story pretty thoroughly in the book that, you know, I was 19 with the, I think he was 73-year-old VP of finance at Swarthmore. And we were the two that got up to present this resolution. You know, we were quite the odd couple up there and led away by security guards in black suits at the end of it. But being able to make our case to the board of directors of Lockheed in front of the shareholders, that was a very powerful experience as a young person and a young person who did not have wealth, right? And kind of showing that having institutional power was a real thing that could be leveraged. And that story became national news. It was my first experience of hate mail, which this will date me. That was handwritten, which is very sweet. But it also kind of spread wildfire across colleges across the nation of students saying, this is really cool. How can I do this? Like, how can I leverage the power of my school's endowment? And that's how we started organizing and how I started working with the investment committees of schools like Columbia and Harvard and, you know, really diving more deeply into these questions of how can impact investments be leveraged across a portfolio? How do you get started? And how do you put it into English? Because I think the other piece that became pretty clear is how finance uses its opaqueness to perpetuate itself in its practices of, oh, don't worry, just turn it over to the advisor. You're not going to understand anyway. And particularly that that's an experience that a lot of women have when they go to a financial advisor. And, you know, given that I think statistically we are inheriting most of the wealth, thank you very much, you know, is something that we need to be paying even more attention to, that women asset owners are extremely powerful and that our posture as a manager is to really try to empower them. To be able to make great decisions and to even be able to say out loud, hey, I don't understand that. Can you break it down for me or stop using acronyms?
Right.
So at any rate, I would say that those very early experiences were part of what taught me both the power of leveraging the economy and investment resources. And then also working for so many years with students was really about how do we put this into English? How do we make this something that's much more accessible as a public conversation? Because I think a lot of people also carry a lot of fear about money, right? That it was something you weren't supposed to talk about, whether you had it, whether you didn't have it, that people see it as a source of stress and scarcity as opposed to a source of joy. And I think the more that we're able to bring people back to, look what your money can be doing in the world, like look at these amazing things, that is a way more fun conversation to have with your advisor than the kind of fear-based, you know, focus on just, am I going to have enough? So ideally with impact investing, you're getting both of those, right?
Just 30 seconds. So my mom, I would go to her with her every once in a while to her advisor. And actually her advisor was a woman and they had a good rapport, but I'd sit there in these meetings and I'd kind of watch and yeah, she was coming at it from a traditional mindset. And it was like the stuff was going over my mom's head. My mom actually could understand a lot of it, but like she just didn't really care about it. And I'm thinking, if you just would listen to clues of what my mom's talking about, like if you could find some stuff, and this wasn't self-serving because we weren't even working with her, but it's like if you could find some stuff that she's passionate about to invest in, you would have her, you know, eating out of the palm of your hand. She would just love you. Well, ironically, she's not with that advisor anymore. And then like you just missed out. I mean, what my mom cares about is giving money away. And then if there's a way for her to make it, do it, you know, in the same vein, it's like, she cares about making money, but she doesn't care about beating, I mean, all the acronyms and that everybody talks about. So yeah, I got to watch it firsthand. All right, I've got two last questions for you. What does stewardship mean for you?
I would love to comment on the last piece with your mom and then sure, we can absolutely go to stewardship. But yeah, I do think it's really important. You know, when I'm having meetings with when I think about even this week, right, the meetings I've gotten to have with my clients, it's talking through an investment in a company that does solar for mostly low income, mostly communities of color, get solar panels without a credit check, and how revolutionary that is to have that sort of access and to be able to you know, to seek a financial return in that project and being able to talk through how that works. I think people find that really interesting. We're working on some fund investments that focus on Black, Latinx, and Indigenous entrepreneurs. We've done recently some investments around ESOPs, which is a mechanism for employee ownership, which we're really excited about. So just to be spending time talking through real things in the real world, that becomes the substance of a meeting with an advisor. Yeah, it is more interesting, I think, obviously, gives you a better story for the cocktail party. You know, it's that these are much, as opposed to just what's the best engineered financial instrument to try to make the most money without actually thinking what the money's doing in the world, it is less interesting. And that we often try to have our investment memos kind of feel like a New Yorker article, right? Because we really are diving deeply into social issues. And then of course, getting into the financial analysis of, do we think this is going to work or not? But I do think that when people get to connect to, here's what your money is and isn't actually doing in the world, that does make for a much more interesting conversation with your advisor.
Well, I've watched that even with my wife, who I mean, obviously she knows what I do and she's been plugged into my career, but you know, it wasn't until we started to invest this way where my wife probably ever asked about how our investments are doing. And she actually has gone to some of the meetings with me. And it's like, man, this, you know, we've done stuff in affordable housing. We, you know, the list goes on stuff we've done. And yeah, it's so cool to see her being engaged. And it's like, in fact, I lent some capital to a guy who was not formally incarcerated, but he's actually committed a crime, admitted to it. And now he's waiting for sentencing. And so his life is in basically a standstill while he's waiting. That's a whole nother issue. I was going to invest in him, but neither my wife and I drink. Not that we think anything's wrong with it. We just don't drink. And so I told my wife about this guy and she's like, well, what is it in? And I said, well, this is what he's doing. It's, you know, it's, he's doing some hard seltzer. And my wife looked at me. He's like, what? I said, just talk to him. I said, just go talk to him. And I'm not going to make an investment without you. She talked to him. And afterwards, she's like, we need to support him. And so, I mean, you talk about a powerful thing of just meeting this person, recognizing that he needed our capital to make one last investment, which hopefully we're still waiting, will set up a runway for him to attract more capital. And we don't, in this case, we don't even care about the business. Now, it's not incongruent with anything that we care about, but we're like, my wife got, she was like, saw him as a person. It's like, I want to get behind him. You know, just a real life example of how somebody, my wife, who doesn't really care about investing per se, meets somebody and goes, Jeff, we need to help support this guy. Pretty cool. So what does stewardship mean to you?
Implicit in the concept of stewardship, which is a little bit different than ownership. I think stewardship implies that you're starting from the place of can't take it with you. And maybe it was never rightfully yours in the first place, right? Like we certainly know there are folks who are dealing with, in some very concrete cases, right? That they know that their origin of their wealth was originally connected to the slave trade, right? And that's something very deep to have to reconcile with in America, but it's just historical fact. It's not a judgment on anybody. It's not a judgment on any inheritors. It simply is just how this country was built. Right. So what do we do with that? What choices do we get to make now as stewards of that capital that on paper also may have ownership, right? Or stewardship can mean in the context of an endowment or a foundation or a pension plan, right? Of really thinking about what are the objectives of money and how are we pursuing that effectively. And I think that stewardship also implies kind of this broader knowledge of even if you are technically managing assets for the benefit of a specific group of stakeholders, that doesn't mean that we get to, you know, put a blind eye, I forget the exact expression, to the way that impacts others, right? So, you know, going back to that example of let's not create wealth for our family by locking up someone else's family. That to me is being thoughtful about stewardship and the broader implications of our capital and making sure that members of the community who benefit from our stewardship, you know, it might be teachers with a pension fund where, you know, they absolutely are dependent on that return to be able to support their families and don't want to support to harm other people's families in that process. It's making sure that we balance that. And also, I think that is the process of internalizing externalities, you know, really from an economic speak perspective that, you know, the other trend that's really interesting to me, and I would say trend, but this goes back to 20 years, right, to the start of my career, that it was really a lot of the big pension funds who were the first to say, look, we own the whole market. And that means that there's no such thing as a social environmental externality. If some company pollutes over here, some other company is going to be stuck with the damage of that, you know, because they're not going to have access to clean water or whatever they might need for their raw materials. So we need to see everybody win or we're going to lose. And I think that kind of broad definition of stewardship of like, literally, we're all on the planet together, right? So you can try through arbitrage to be able to tap certain opportunities for a very time-limited basis, but ultimately, you're going to be stuck on that same planet, right? So I think that's where stewardship is also just broadening the lens of economic thinking so that it's not just about what am I going to do this quarter? Like, I don't know about you and your wife, but I'm not going to retire next quarter, right? So that's not the time frame that I'm most interested in. I'm really looking at the long term, and that's most people, right? So from that perspective, stewardship is saying, I win when everybody wins. And I need to be really kind of opening my aperture from a decision-making perspective to make sure I'm getting all the inputs that can really enable me to see the impact of my capital.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've talked about is, and you know this phrase very well, is fiduciary. And fiduciary is a legal term and is really obviously about me and, in theory, my client. I actually love the word stewardship, and I'd love for that. I mean, it's never going to take over, but I'd love for that almost to be inserted on top of fiduciary, because in my opinion, and you just described this, this is called, it's not just about my relationship to me and my investor, but it's about relationship to me, my investor, and then the stakeholders of which we invest. And so I just think this idea of stewardship is so much even bigger than fiduciary. But I mean, I know that terminology will never take off, but this idea of looking out for a broader stakeholder group, I think, is just critical. And you know, I'm a capitalist at heart. I think we see enough examples out there where capitalism is turned over to greed and becomes very exploitive. And, you know, eventually the world's going to stand up. And I think they are saying that this doesn't fly. So I think that's the good news about capitalism. Ultimately, hopefully over time, there's mechanisms in place that can correct it. So the last question, if you could make one dream come true for your life, what would it be?
There's a quote that I'm from a dancer that I'm going to maybe misattribute. Forgetting if it's Isadora Duncan or Martha Graham. I'm a big dancer. It's a big part of my life. The quote is that they want to make sure they end life thoroughly used up.
Okay.
And I think with that, I'd like to be thoroughly used up because I've also passed everything on. And going back to what I'd mentioned earlier, you know, whether it's within my team or more broadly within the work that we do, I think that we need a rapid acceleration of social change. And that part of how we do that is really kind of crawling up the efficiency curve. When it comes to how long it takes for us to really view capital differently, to create the infrastructure, to have things work in the world. I feel like we're seeing that in terms of that explosion. I'm proud to have been there at the beginning, but I'm always going to feel like it's not enough. So I think the feeling that at the same time, we all kind of make our individual contribution, but if we can do it in a way that people grow from it and are able to kind of build and branch off of it, that's what I hope to be able to show up and do. And I hope to have a lot of fun while I'm doing it. But that's part of what I think would have made all this work worthwhile for me.
As somebody who's watched you from afar, you clearly are making a difference, not only in the space, but obviously for the families you work with and the capital that's been deployed on their behalf. Where can people find your book or follow you if they want to?
Sure. So at MorganSimon1 on Twitter and Instagram are great places to look. And those tend to have a good mix of both investment expertise and dance videos. So, you know, for people like a little amusement in their day. and then MorganSimon.com, you can find the book, or just, you know, Amazon, Busboys and Poets, if you want to go indie, and the name of the book is Real Impact.
So if I ever get a chance to go into a prison in your area, would you join me?
Absolutely. We have done a lot of work, around mass incarceration, you know, both from the family separation perspective, but the recognition that family separation was not just a one-time phenomena about immigration, but happens every time that someone goes into a prison or jail. And that, you know, beyond that, I think it's about 77% of people in jails haven't actually been convicted of a crime yet, right? But a lot of that is really just about how expensive bail is for families. So from that perspective, there's so much work that needs to be done. And also to really look at what are the ways that people often unwittingly wind up profiting off the mass incarceration system. So that's an area that we've tried to do a lot of education and partnership in trying to see how we can make money more of a positive tool. So yes, always, always happy to spend time with our incarcerated brothers and sisters.
Well, I'll have to send you some podcasts, if I've not, of some of my friends who have been in prison and are doing some amazing things today. In fact, one of them recently was interviewed on the Ellen DeGeneres show, and that will air here fairly soon. So it's pretty exciting. Great. So yeah, there's some good stuff happening. Well, look, I don't want to take you more time. We appreciate your insights and knowledge and your willingness to share your stories with us. Clearly, you're a leader in the space, and commend you for what you're doing and the work you've done. I mean, I know that I feel the headwinds myself, so I can only imagine what you have felt over the years, but it's encouraging just to see what you've been able to accomplish. So don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice, and please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on the path to a more fulfilling portfolio with the impact investing space. Morgan, thanks so much. Anything you want to say in closing?
Just thank you for having me, and that I hope people, you know, listening get the opportunity to really think through that question of what is the legacy that I want to leave.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.